nothing quite better than starting the morning off stuck in traffic, getting here just in the nick of time. Although, I guess it's better than when we had to deal with it one day. Half an inch of snow and college gets closed. I have no idea what the heck happened to our society. It is what it is, though. All right, let's see. Zach?
Yes, sir.
All right, very good. Yeah. Roman?
Right here.
Okay. Allison? All right, very good. Jaden with Drew because of work conflict. Too bad. Elizabeth? Good morning. Cadence? Good. Wow. We're in a row, although we're going to break it at some point. Nick? No. See, I told you. Is Joshua here? I don't even know if he's still in the register. Young man, what's your name?
Nicholas.
Oh, look at that. Good. We got the streak going. Gage. All right. Well, we'll both help. Is it? It's Chime?
Chimmy.
Chimmy. Chimmy. Okay. Chris?
Yeah.
All right. Very good. Eli? No. Ernst? Ernest. And Rich. All right. No big deal. Again, traffic is crazy. Getting into the city, I don't know where y'all come from, but I come from south of Worcester, just trying to get on to the 290 and then trying to get off of 190. Awful. Awful. But it is what it is. All right, so, just throwing it out there, because I'm not putting a time limit on it. How many of you got my message Monday morning? Okay, good. How many of you did what you were supposed to do? Outstanding. Very good. If you didn't have a chance to watch the video, please do so. Any questions from the video? Okay. The nice thing about the video is I know I talked fast. I'm sitting there at my desk in the morning and I'm half asleep. But if I spoke too fast, you have the ability to at least rewind. So it's not as effective as saying, Professor, you know, ask a question in class. But, you know, it is what it is.
I like your Star Wars gear.
Oh, yeah. Old school fan, that's for sure. So, if we're good with everything we covered, we're going to go forward to our second unit. And what we're going to do is we're going to do a deep dive into the Constitution. Because in order to understand what the government is doing, we got to start on the ground level and see what should the government be doing. Once we understand what the government should be doing, then that will help us with our politics. Because again, you can have an opinion on anything you want, but if the basis of your opinion is wrong, then you may look kind of silly. So at the very least, if we can understand what is in that document, why was it put into place, how did they get to the point when they needed to do that? Then when we see the stuff that's going on in the world and like everyone's losing their mind, we can kind of take a step back and say, and make a good decision, make a good judgment. Our Constitution is one of the most important written frames of government in the world of all times. Because it literally is the ground upon which our country is built. All of our political system at the national level is based upon this document. Now, one of the biggest things to remember is why it's there. You know, I hear this when I talk to people, and it frustrates me at how little people have learned, even though we have the opportunity to know anything we want in this modern era. But I hear it over and over again. The Constitution gives us rights. Ugh! Oh, my head just goes boom, like a balloon. No! The purpose of the government is to tell the government what it can do. Because the purpose of the Constitution is to put a barrier between the government and us by limiting government action. So the government does, I mean, the Constitution doesn't tell us what we can do, but rather it tells the government what it can't do, and it leaves everything else to us. That was the vision of the Founding Fathers. You create a limited government, and you leave the people alone. Now, of course, we can't ignore the fact that the Constitution was written in 1787, and we are now in 2025. A lot of things have happened since the Constitution was written in our country. A lot of big things, a lot of bad things, a lot of good things, lots of change. But at the core, this document still can serve the purpose that it was intended to refrain the government from interfering in our lives, to allow us life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, the irony is that when the Founding Fathers sat down and put quill to parchment, paper to pen, or pen to paper, they didn't just make shit up. They looked to history, going all the way back to the very foundations of Western society, because they recognize something that is very simple. Homo sapiens, our current form, if you believe in evolution, has had the same mental capabilities since it first appeared on this earth. So what does that mean? Well, people in our modern society think, oh, we know so much more than those people. We're smarter than them. Actually, the truth is they were just as smart as we are. What does that mean? Well, they had problems. They tried solving them to the best of their ability. Sometimes they got it right. Sometimes they got it really wrong. So what the Founding Fathers did is they didn't say, oh, we know everything, so we're going to dictate. No, they said, what happened in the past? Let's look at where people did good things and look to that for examples. But we'll also look to what went wrong, and we'll use that also. And at the end of the day, they basically brought it all together. They looked to the Bible. They looked to ancient Greek philosophers. They looked to the English legal system. They even looked at the events that happened in the years before they sat down to write the document. They kept all that in their minds when they developed this system of government. All right, questions? Now, if you want to make it simple, because we don't have time to cover everything, one good area to look at is the 100 years of thought that was going on in Europe before the Founding Fathers wrote the document. Sometimes it's called the Age of Reason. Sometimes it's called the Enlightenment. But beginning in around 1690, and going all the way up until the 1780s, there were many people in Europe trying to reform society. All of those people were either living in a tyrannical monarchy like the people in the French, or in a constitutional monarchy of sorts like in England. And they were basically trying to liberate the human being, the human spirit, by fixing government, fixing the economy, fixing the church. And there were many thinkers associated with this movement. So they weren't the people in government telling the people what to do. They were just philosophers. And they wrote books. And they made suggestions. Well, this is what I think. This is where we should go. Maybe we can improve a little bit. Of all of the writers, there were two that if you read through the Constitution, you can see their ideas shining clearly. The first is, in my humble opinion, one of the most influential political scientists of all times. It was an English philosopher by the name of John Locke. John Locke was born and came of age in England during the 17th century. And if you've ever had an opportunity to take a class that covers that time period, a lot of zany, wacky things were going on in England. There was the English Civil War that ended with them killing their king, literally cutting the king's head off. Then they had a few years where they had no monarchy. They tried creating a republic, and that ended up almost worse than the monarchy was, so they decided to bring the king monarchy back. Then they had a good king, and then right after the good king, they had a bad king. And they decided to have a glorious revolution. Crazy things that were going on. But at the end, each event was motivated by people trying to get the government out of their homes, to get the government off their backs, to essentially establish the right to be left alone. Well, in 1690, John Locke, who many believe is the father of the Enlightenment, would write several books and pamphlets, all of which would be absorbed by the Founding Fathers. Of them, the most important was the Second Treatise on Government. The Second Treatise on Civil Government. In it, Locke lays out the basic idea of what a good government is. Because prior to this, you had bad kings who were tyrants and people were abused, and there was nothing the people could do. If they dared speak out, they would be labeled a traitor to the crown, subject to attainment. What the hell is attainment, Professor Lanik? England had a system where if the king didn't like you, he could get Parliament to pass a law that attains you, which basically labels you as an antisocial demon, like a cancer. Once this law was passed, the government would come in and basically try to erase you from existence. You would lose all your rights, you would lose all your privileges, you would lose your titles, you would lose your lands, and that would apply to your family forever. So with that type of power, I think we all can reasonably assume that there were a lot of people in England probably not happy with the kings and queens, but they did a lot of ass-kicking because they didn't want to be attainted. Well, the English Civil War, resulting in the execution of King Charles because King Charles was interfering with the rights of the people. He was alive. He was a kid, but he was alive. It was a lot of chaos. He was alive when Oliver Cromwell came in and established the Commonwealth. Chaos, violence, tyranny. He was alive when King Charles II was put on the throne. Good king, worked with Parliament. And he was alive when King James II came to the throne, who ultimately would be removed in that event, the Glorious Revolution. A bloodless coup d'etat, where basically Parliament rose up and said to the king, "You're fired." And they brought in a king who promised to protect the rights of the people. This book talks about it. Locke establishes what he referred to as the social contract. He said that any society is based on a contract between the government and the people. Any of you take business law yet? What's a contract? What are the elements of a contract? Do you remember?
It's a bond. It's like a bond between you and somebody else that you like can't break and that you sign on to.
Okay. How do you get into the contract? No. Signing is a simple.
You, like, make meetings and talk about
it. Yeah, one party has to make a proposal to the other. There has to be an offer. And then, yes, you negotiate, you bargain for exchange and hem and haw and all the rest, haggle. But at some point, both parties accept the terms. Then when they accept, they do some type of symbol. They sign, if it's a written contract. It could be something as easy as a handshake. But the moment that contract is made, both sides have obligations to go through and perform whatever is required in the contract.
That being said, how come if we break the rules of the contract, we get punished, but if the government breaks the rules of the contract, nothing happens to it?
That's not necessarily true. Let me finish and I'll circle back to you. John Locke argued that this contract is based on two components. That the people give their consent, and that consent is the basis of government legitimacy. Essentially, these are the things that the people allow the government to do. The government can only do the things that the people allow them to do. At its core, life, liberty, property. That is the primary function, according to John Locke, to a good government. Government creates laws and regulations aimed at protecting your ability to live, to have freedom, and to obtain stuff. Now, because the government is doing this, we are obligated to follow the laws. And in a perfect society, the government will only make reasonable, just laws that only protect our LLPs. But, like in contract law, what happens if either party fails to do what they promised to do? Well, there's consequences. Essentially, the contract's null and void. That's called breach. Well, if an individual breaches the contract, breaking the law, they get punished. If the government breaks the promise, then it's the right of the people to alter or abolish the government and make something better. So, what happens if we have an elected official that's not doing what they're supposed to do? How do we alter or abolish them in our system?
Can remove them from that position.
They can get impeached, they can get unelected. You know, there's ways to get them out. And then they get replaced with someone who promises to do this, and if they don't, you repeat. Now, is the system perfect? No. In reality, are there times when the government oversteps? Absolutely. But do we have the ability to get compensation if they overstep? Where do we got to go?
Court.
We got to go to court. Is it an easy process? No. Does it take a lot of energy? Yes. But in the end, if government really overstepped, you will be compensated for it. Question.
Just one about the timeline. What was the timeline around the English Civil War? What years was this taking place?
Trying to think. Charles had his years where he ruled without parliament. That was, I think, 17 years. He got beheaded, I'm pretty sure it was 1347. So I think the English Civil, sorry, not 13, that was stupid. 1647, so I think it started 1641.
It's just an area of history that I haven't heard about very often. It's not talked about, nearly to the extent of the American Revolution and the French Revolution.
The funny thing is the concepts that came out of that and what motivated us for us to do our revolution.
Right. And the concepts that came out of that is what motivated the French ostensibly to do their revolution.
100%. 100%. All right, other questions? Now, by the way, if this sounds familiar, Thomas Jefferson plagiarized. Why? Because that was the view, 100 years after this book was read, of all of the founding fathers. They believe that a legal form of government adheres to the will of the people. That it takes actions based upon the consent. But keep in mind, like any contract, consent is ongoing. Just because people 200 years ago agreed to this, we, every single generation, continue to give our consent to the government. And so long as the government in general does what it's supposed to do, we, as a society, follow the government. Regardless of who's in charge. And by the way, are there going to be people who are going to resist the current administration? Yeah, that's politics. But at the end of the day, always remember, the people who make the most noise, the activists, as you were referring to last class, or the last time we were together, they are the minority. They represent a single percent of society. The vast majority of people sit back and say, so long as I have a job, so long as I make enough money so I can take care of my family, pay my bills, go on vacation. The vast majority of people don't care about the D or the R, the Democrat or the Republican. They just want a government that's going to leave them alone and let them live. Now, not only did Locke contribute a philosophical idea upon which the Constitution is based, he also added to our political lexicon key concepts which were not thought of during his day, but we today take for granted. One big one is the sense of equality. He was one of the first people to say that all men and women are born equal. And that the moment we're born, we are entitled to certain basic rights. Rights that don't come from government, but come from a higher power. Now, by the way, that was exactly counter to the rules when he was alive, even though England was changing. But back then, there was an emphasis on a fixed social class that had rights, and the lower classes had nothing. Locke was one of the first people to say, yeah, you may come from that special family that has title, the nobles, but you're no different than the lowest of the peasant. You all are entitled to the right of life, liberty, and property. This undermined tradition. This was revolutionary. Because he says that that higher power basically makes the rules that even the government should follow. Laws given to us by nature itself. God, if you believe, we are all entitled to the same things. We have a right to exist and be prosperous and be happy. And no one should interfere. Again, like we said on day one, you have your sphere, you can do whatever you wanted, but there's a line, my circle can't interfere with yours. Questions. All right, well, this is great. Pie in the sky, upper level philosophical idealism. How do you make it work? How do you bring that to fruition? Well, for that, I'll give you my second philosopher, Charles Secondat. who is formerly known as the Baron de Montesquieu. Locke was English, Montesquieu, French. When Locke wrote his book, he was talking positively about the Glorious Revolution, the removal of James II. When Montesquieu wrote his book, he was criticizing the political system that existed in France. Now, ironically, there was a weird dynamic in Europe during this time. England was moving towards freedom, liberty, individual rights. But France was living under the most powerful, tyrannical, absolutist system devised, created by Louis XIV, the Sun King, who literally had power over the lives of every single man and woman in his country. There was no checks and balances. There was no separation of power. He had total control. So in his book, Montesquieu is kind of scratching his head saying, wait, people just on the other side of the English Channel, other human beings, just like us, are moving towards freedom, but we're accepting tyranny? That makes no sense. So he wrote a book to encourage his fellow Frenchmen to essentially break the power under which they were living in, to reform the system. And his book was The Spirit of the Laws. He basically began criticizing the French absolutist system, labeling it as being despotic, tyrannical. So what he wanted to do is put forth a proposal on how to counter despotism. And what he said was, 40 years before our Constitution was written, that the best model that history has shown us to ensure that government will be put in check is a republic, res publica. Plato's Politeia, that I talked about in the video. Why? Well, simple. By creating a republic, you can create a system where the government's natural tendencies to abuse the people can be restrained. You don't give all authority to one person who has the power to make the laws, to enforce the laws, and to adjudicate the laws. No, you create a system that is locked into separating powers. Just like the Romans did when they overthrew the last Etruscan king. Rome had a monarchy where the king had full imperium. He had all the power. Make the laws, enforce the laws, led the army, was the high judge, was the high priest. And the Romans, in and around 510, decided we don't want to live in that system. So they overthrew him and they separated the imperium, the powers of government, and gave it to different branches, different entities of government. Montesquieu said, look, there is a point in history where people went from living under despotism and suddenly had freedom. He argued, I don't know if there's another click, no there's not, so I gotta go back, that the basic powers of government, making the laws, that power should be placed in a legislature, some type of parliament or Congress, where the people elect the men and women who draft the laws for the society. By doing so, they will represent what the people want, because they come from the people. Now, of course, you do need a powerful entity to enforce the laws made by the will of the people. Montesquieu said, if you have a monarchy, it can be the monarch. But the monarch has to be benevolent. He has to be educated. He has to be respectful. He can't be a tyrant. But if you can't get a tyrant, then you can elect an executive. And then you separate the power of judgment, adjudication, by creating a separate court system where the judges don't have to answer to anybody. The courts will be independent. Because through judicial independence, you have a legal system that is blind.
So you take the ideas of Locke and you stitch it together with Montesquieu, and boom, you got our Constitution. Questions?
Well, here's the other thing. The framers were not dumb. They also understood that they and their ancestors had a unique experience that was different than what was going on elsewhere in the world. Everybody in the Atlantic colonies got on a boat and came here. And once they were here, they had certain experiences that were shared. But at their core, every single colony had written law as the guiding point. There was no nobility over here. There were no people that claimed, I was born of this family, and my family has traditionally had rights and privileges, and because of my last name, I'm entitled to them. No. We had true equality here. Anyone could come across, and if they worked hard, could eventually become rich. But they had the same chance of screwing things up and losing everything. But to bring order, they wrote everything down. And those are the rules that everyone had to abide by. One of the most important expressions of law that the colonists embraced was the English common law system. The common law system is an area of the law that evolved over hundreds of years and came down from decisions made by judges. The law of murder, the law of fraud, the law of assault. Those laws were all rules that judges made based on decisions in cases. But in order to ensure justice, they started writing everything down in books. And other judges and lawyers studied those rules and began applying them in similar situations.
So when you say common law here, you're referring to essentially just jurisprudence versus the modern understanding of what common law means?
It's one and the same to a degree.
Okay.
Because common law came from the courts.
Right.
This is not me.
But this is just a precedent set by...
100%, yeah. Stare decisis and all the rest. Yeah. We'll get deep dive when we do the judicial branch. So, what does this mean? Well, you could have consistency. You could have order to society. So, let's say, hypothetically, you entrust me to take care of your cow because you are going to town, which is about 5 miles away, but it's a day trip, because again, you have to go by foot, and then you have to go to the marketplace, and you have to barter for some new, thatch for your roof. So I agree, okay, I'll watch your cow, I'll put your cow in my barn. But the moment I take possession of your cow and put it in my barn and you walk away, a violent windstorm happens and my barn collapses. Because I was a lazy son of a bitch and I didn't maintain the structural integrity of my barn. So my negligence was responsible for the destruction of your property. What could you do? You could sue me. Take me to court, and if you could prove the elements of negligence, then the court would award you the fair value of the cow. Same basic facts, but instead of it being a cow, you give me your automobile. And instead of me being a farmer, I'm a mechanic. We go from an event that could have taken place in the 15th century, fast forward to something in the 21st century. I'm a mechanic, you give me your car, so I promise you I'm going to fix it. I put it in the garage collapses. What do? You sue me for negligence, you have to prove the elements of negligence, and if you win, I have to give you the fair market value of your automobile. That's common law. The courts don't focus on the facts. The court focuses on the processes. And it makes rules to get basically the same outcome. Regardless of the fact that we're talking about situations that are 700 years apart. Another thing that the colonists inherited, the idea of limited government. Fast forward back to 1215. King John of England, the younger brother of Richard the Lionheart, is on the throne and is imposing taxes upon the land. And all of the English barons rise up because John is taking money to raise an army to go to war against France. To reclaim all the English lands that were lost. Well, the problem is it was John's incompetence that caused France to basically take over all those lands. And John had already sent over two armies, and the armies got decimated. Now he wants money, more money, to do this? Well, the barons rose up and they said no. They met on the battlefield and they defeated his army. And when the battle was over, they forced the king to sign the Magna Carta, the Great Charter. At its core, this is an agreement, a contract between the sovereign and the barons. And in this contract, the king basically agrees to a series of promises that restrains his power, limits his ability to interfere with the lives of the people. Why? Well, as the Magna Carta says, it is the people who are the real power source of the state. Founding Fathers also look to another written expression of law, the English Bill of Rights. Similar to the Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights was drafted after the Glorious Revolution. James II, legal King of England, is chased off the throne, and Parliament replaces him with William III and his wife, Mary II. These co-sovereigns, the only married couple in English history where both the king and queen were equal, agreed to limit the power of the monarchy. In the English Bill of Rights, you see things like the king's and queen's promise to have trial by jury. You see an acknowledgement of freedom of speech. You see an acknowledgement of the right to keep and bear arms. And there's also a promise that the monarchs are under the law. That even though they are sovereigns, they are bound to the law just like everybody else. Years before, a bunch of people were on a boat coming to this place to establish a new life for themselves. But the problem was, is on board the Mayflower, there were Puritans, the people we call the Pilgrims. But there also were more people who were not of that faith. They all were coming over to have an opportunity to build a community in which they could profit, to make a life for themselves. But as they're coming over, they realize everyone is there for a different reason. Everyone has a different agenda. They have different goals. But how are we going to work together as a team? What the Mayflower Compact was an agreement between all of the people on that boat that they would work collaboratively as a community for the well-being of all. They also acknowledged that, yes, there are rights that come from the grand creator, God. But we're going to give up some of those rights so we can have a functioning community. Everyone on board put their name to paper, pledging to support the system, giving consent to the decisions that their government, which they would create, and the rules that it would generate for all. And lastly, all 13 colonies also had their own form of written expressions of laws. They all had charters. They all laid out the system under which the colonial government would operate. This is Massachusetts, or as it was known, Massachusetts Bay Colony. This is Pennsylvania, and I think this one's Rhode Island. Each document basically created a government for the colony. There would be an assembly where members of the community could elect representatives. And they would join together and make the rules for the colony. There would also be executive officers whose responsibility it would be to enforce the laws. And there would also be some type of court. So what happens if neighbor had a dispute against the neighbor? A dead cow. Well, you wouldn't pick out your muskets and go duel. No, you'd go to court. And you would allow a judge to render a decision.
These colonists had generation after generation after generation lived under a set of parameters. Everything was codified. So that way, if it was any type of dispute, you could look to it and say, okay, the government can do this. The government cannot do that. Why? That's what the charter says. That's what the English Bill of Rights says. That's what Magna Carta says. Rules to keep society going.
Another thing that makes the English colonists' experience different
particularly during the 17th century, when all that stuff was going on, the Civil War, the Commonwealth, Glorious Revolution, all that stuff, England was not actually governing the colonies. They practiced what formally is known as salutary neglect. Yeah, the government makes laws, but intentionally doesn't enforce it. Well, for almost 200 years, the men and women living over here had been making their own rules, had been organizing their own society. Yes, they're part of the English Empire, but the king isn't coming over and telling people what to do. No, the people are making the decisions based on what is best for them. And ultimately, what would evolve is the common held belief that the colonial governments should do what's best for the colonists. Who cares what's going on in England? We don't need them. Without all of these factors, this would not have happened. Because why is it after 100 and almost 200 years of living over here, a group of colonists finally said, England, go pound sand? What was it that happened? What triggered the Tea Party? Lexington and Concord, Bunker Hill. Do you want to know the funny thing about the tax that caused the Tea Party? It was actually lower than it had been. But we'll believe the Sons of Liberty's propaganda.
No taxation without representation.
Didn't they fight because they didn't want a tax on tea?
Right, but the irony was is the tax that the Crown put on the tea under the Tea Act was actually lower than the tax had been. The law actually gave the colonists a tax break. But in creating the tax break, what ended up happening is tea was coming over cheaper than the smugglers could bring it in.
Was it like the 1,000 soldiers that they...
Well, that would instigate things too, but again, the soldiers were sent over here because we didn't have police. Anything else? I'll deal with whatever you want. Give you the other side. I can do that.
Loyalist.
It's cold. Hey, I support His Majesty's government.
They had an experience with self-government, right? And they believed that they could do it better than it was being done from what was in their mind a tyrant 3,000 miles away, and how dissociated the government was from their local, from the colonies. I think that's ultimately what it came down to.
100%. Do you all hear that? I'll give you one analogy, my favorite story I love to hear. Imagine if, and I know this doesn't apply to any of you, because you are all saints, but imagine if your mom and dad were disinterested parents, and they allowed you to grow up and become spoiled, a selfish, rotten brat. You go to the store when you're a kid, you throw your little tantrum, and mom and dad throw a chocolate bar in your face. Shut up, kid! You go home, you whine and complain. Mom and dad go out and get you an Xbox. Shut up, kid! They just let you do whatever you want, and they give you little tokens to shut you up. But then, you get to be 17. You get your license, and you go out, and you wrap the car around a telephone pole. Dad comes in, pissed. And for the first time in your life, you are punished. Disciplined. You are grounded. He's taking the keys. He's taking your phone. He's shutting off the internet. And suddenly, he starts acting like a parent. 17 years later, what are you going to do?
Late.
That's exactly what you said. For all those years, the English were not actually governing the colonies. They'd been doing it all themselves, and they were fine. They figured out ways to get whatever commodity they needed outside of the laws of the empire. But what started happening is when the crown suddenly started coming in and governing, the colonists threw a temper tantrum. And it was that temper tantrum that would ultimately culminate in blood flowing in the streets, death, and the eventual revolution.
And why were they revolting? Well, simple.
They were God-made creatures that had rights that came from the Creator. And what was England trying to do? Let's make new regulations on who can sell tea. Let's make new regulations on who has a license to do business at the different points in the empire. Let's make regulations that require the colonists to contribute to the overall economy of the empire. Well, the moment England started governing the colonies after the French and Indian War, the colonists who had been left alone generation after generation freaked out. No taxation without representation.
In every act that the crown passed, they responded with politics.
So, in the wake of the Boston Tea Party, England passed a bunch of laws aimed solely at punishing the people responsible for the destruction of private property. Because when that group of Mohawk Indians snuck on board the ship and dumped over about 70,000 pounds of tea, that tea was the private property of the British East India Company. And under our common law system, anyone responsible for the destruction of property can be punished in the courts. Well, the problem is the British East India Company didn't know who to sue, because the Indians magically disappeared into the streets of Boston. Even though the Indians, some of them had a striking resemblance to people like Samuel Adams and John Hancock. But when no one would turn over those responsible, England started, under a system based on laws, passing laws that were aimed at holding those responsible accountable. They shut down Boston Harbor. No more commodities would come in and out of the port. They suspended the Colonial Assembly, because many of the Sons of Liberty were actually in the colonial government, resisting the laws of the empire. They also brought in the soldiers, because there was lawlessness in the city of Boston. They passed these laws through a legal system, the system that was in place. And by the way, before the laws were enacted, they were all sent over here, so everybody had a chance to read the laws in advance, but no one responded. What's that saying? Silence is acceptance? So when no one said anything, England said, okay, we're all subjects of a system of laws, subject to the rule of law. Well, here are the laws, now we have to follow. And what did they do? They rose up and rebelled. They started gathering arms. Powder, shot, with the intent of actually fighting back. So instead of bringing the people who were responsible for the Tea Party forward and having them or giving them an opportunity to face justice, they threw a temper tantrum and rebelled. And the consequence was thousands of people died. They lost their homes, they lost their property. But at the end of the day, we broke away from England. And then after we did, each one of the new states, and by the way, I use the state in quote, because in the minds of that generation, each of the former colonies were now independent countries with full sovereignty over their geographical boundaries. These states made constitutions, which would be the frame of government for that state.
course, we already talked about the Massachusetts Constitution. The only one that was written not by the government of the state, but rather by the delegates sent by the towns and approved by the voters. But each of these constitutions looked to history. They had separation of powers. They put in checks and balances to prevent any branch from becoming tyrannical. They included bills of rights. And essentially what they did was create these constitutions to be like contracts. They're agreements between the government and the governed. Thus, all of the history was being enshrined in these written documents. Well, now you got 13 independent countries. How do you prevent them from fighting against one another? Particularly when they all rebelled together. Well, you try to make a frame of government that brings all of the countries together, the states. They would create a national government. And this first attempt is known as the Articles of Confederation, which is, I believe, contained in the index of your book. The full title of this document is the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. The idea was simple. Once the states were bound, they were united together for common cause. Now, interestingly enough, it was made during the war. Down in Philadelphia, there was a gathering of delegates, representatives sent by the states, known as the Continental Congress. After Lexington and Concord, or before Lexington and Concord, you had the First Continental Congress, but that really didn't do much. But it was the Second Continental Congress that got into action, including putting forward the Declaration of Independence. But in addition to submitting the Declaration of Independence, in which we're telling King George to go pound sand, the delegates realized, okay, once we declare our independence, now what? We have to create a government so we can make treaties with other countries. Maybe we can get loans. Maybe we can get weapons, ships, support. They knew the countries abroad would not talk to 13 independent countries. So let's put them together into common cause. The committee that would draft this would be chaired by one of our founding fathers by the name of John Dickinson, whose name will come up when I talk about the Constitution. And this committee basically formulated seven articles, seven different sections that would lay out this confederation. After 7 months of debate, revision, tweaking, the finished document was put before the Continental Congress, and they voted on it, and they adopted it on November 15, 1777. But the weird thing is they had no authority to make a national government. So the fact that they made it is meaningless. What they then had to do is they had to send it to the different states to allow the states' governments to deal with it. Under the terms of the articles, all 13 had to sign on. It had to be unanimous. But because there was a war going on, it would take 3.5 years for that unanimity to be achieved. The first state to adopt it was Virginia, and then the final state was Maryland. After Maryland submitted its consent to it, it would go into operation just as the War of Independence was winding down. March 1st, 1781. With this new government, you had a creation of a union known as a confederation. Technically, it was a league called the United States of America. Real quick, does anybody know how a confederation functions? The basis of the confederation are the parts of which it's comprised. So we didn't have a country. We had an alliance.
We have like smaller states, right?
Each of the 13, yeah, the parts basically control the whole. So what does this mean? Well, essentially, each state would be theoretically equal because no state could tell one another what to do. But simultaneously, the Union couldn't tell the states what to do. The states were in charge of the system. They had a Congress, but the Congress was a forum. It was like the United Nations. So they would send representatives, and the representatives could debate and talk about things. But that Congress did not have authority to mandate to the states. It could make requests. Depending on population, each state could send delegates. And again, the smaller states were allowed to send two. The larger states could send up to about seven. But more importantly, if you were a small state but a rich state, so you could pay more, you could pick up extra delegates. Delegates would be elected by the state governments, so not by the people of the state, but by the state governments, and they would serve one-year terms. Interestingly enough, they had term limits. Out of a six-year window, the delegates could only serve 3 years. So some of the delegates went every other year. Some did two on, one off, went back for one, gone for two, and then came back. 6 year window, could only serve three out of that six. There was no executive branch. There was no judiciary. Now, there was an executive committee. But all the executive committee did was basically run the sessions. The chairman was called the president because he was the presiding officer. The biggest job of the president was to allow the newly elected delegates to come in and take part of the sessions. The president was chosen by the members of the Congress. And they too served one-year terms. And they were not allowed to serve as president more than 1 year out of every three. So they wanted to keep the chair rotating. Questions? Yes?
After those six or 3 years were up,
restart?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. Now, do you want to know something really interesting? A lot of the time when a delegate would come, sometimes, typically they served 2 years, but then they would be given an assignment. So they would leave the Congress and then go serve. For instance, Thomas Jefferson would go over to England as an ambassador. And then if he wanted to, when they came back, they could get appointed again.
Was it like Benjamin Franklin in France during most of the Revolutionary War?
Yep, yep. John Adams would eventually go over, Jefferson would go over, yeah, a bunch of the Founding Fathers would go over. Now, there's a lot of talk about the Articles of Confederation, you know, the good versus the bad, yes.
Wasn't there one president who just kept getting elected to the point they had to make the 4-year term?
No. No, I think every single year that the Articles of Confederation was operational, there was different presidents.
I think she's referring to FDR.
Oh, the United States president?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that. That's the modern president. All right. Functionally speaking, there were many weaknesses. They could have been overcome, but these made this government really difficult in terms of operations. The first is, each delegation, representing each of the 13 states, only had one vote. One vote. So whether your delegation had 2 members or 7, you only got one vote on every single action. So what does that mean? Well, if you had an even amount of delegates, you had your 2, or you had a 4, or you had 6, and the delegates were split, your state essentially was a no vote. So the delegates had to do politicking amongst themselves if the state wanted them to pass something. And one of the weirdest things is the delegates didn't have to do what their own sending states told them to do.
Why?
There was no requirement. Hmm. Plus there was no GPS or cell phone technology. So you're sitting up in New York or Philadelphia for a while, and you're basically doing what you want. Now, if the state found out you were doing things the state didn't want, you wouldn't get sent back. But if a measure was up to vote, and you're like, well, I'm not voting for it because I don't like the people in Massachusetts, you could actually stymie laws. Most of the laws that were passed required a 2/3 majority. 9 out of the 13 states to agree. Now, have you ever had a gathering of people, all of your friends together, and you figure out what movie we want to go see? Or what restaurant do we want to go out to? You think you can get most of them to agree on one thing?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see. Let's put my theory to the test. How many of you believe, as I do, that God, proof that God exists is with the creation of anchovy pizza? Show of hands. We're going to have anchovy pizza for dinner tonight. Shit. All right. Hawaiian pizza. God, you are like the Antichrist.
You like anchovies on your pizza.
Yeah, that's yummy and salty and delicious. All right, so look at that. We have 2 options. We haven't got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Oh, so we'll probably have to be 8 out of 11. All right, chicken Alfredo pizza?
That's just banging. I love that.
How many people chicken Alfredo?
I would put God in there.
4, 5, 6, 7. No, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. All right, fine. Plain pizza.
That's sour.
Okay, fine. Onion and pepper pizza. Pepperoni pizza.
Hey, there he is.
Screw pizza, we're having tacos tonight. Look at that.
Yeah.
we could not agree on a single type of pizza. So we had to scrap the pizzas and do something else. Trying to imagine having a government that way? How does it work? How does it function?
It's chaos. But there were some really big weaknesses. And ultimately, it would be these weaknesses that caused many people to say, eh, maybe we don't want the articles anymore. The Congress could not impose taxes. In order to raise government money, they had to ask the states. The Congress could not create an army. The Congress could appoint officers, but they had to ask the states to send soldiers. The Congress, by the way, I think these are in the book. The Congress cannot regulate commerce. Literally, once this government was operations, the states would engage in trade wars with one another. And there was nothing the government could do about it. And if those three were bad enough, no taxes, no army, no regulating the economy, in order to amend the articles, you had to get unanimity. 13 out of 13 delegations to agree. Even when we went to the Compromise of Tacos, it did not have unanimous consent. Now, just to wrap it up, we'll give you some of the strengths. Again, these are in the book. The Congress would have the power to declare war, not the states. The Congress was allowed to make alliances and peace treaties. The Congress could make a quota on the number of soldiers that each state had to raise. Similarly, the Congress could put a quota on its request for money. But as I said previously, there was no enforcement mechanism. So the Congress could ask, but the states didn't have to comply. So example, 1783, the Congress would send a request to the states to raise money to help pay our loans to France. They needed $3.8 million. Guess how much money came in? $663. Just to finish up, I know I'm at the time. Congress could settle disputes between the states. The Congress could admit new states. The Congress could borrow money, make a currency, make a post office, and deal with Indians. Now, good and bad, this was an experiment. Nothing like it had ever been created in world history. But the Founding Fathers looked at all their experiences and basically said, you know, why did we break away from England? We didn't want an all-powerful government that could tell us what to do. So let's see if we can make a system where the central government is weak, that it can be controlled by the parts. And only do those absolute things that are necessary. Now, would it work? Well, no spoilers. We'll look at that on Monday. Questions?
When did the Articles of Confederation come to an end?
When the Constitution went into action. All right. One thing I do want to remind you of. You have a paper to write in this class. Talked about it on the first day. The paper is something that's related to our, what we're talking about, government, United States government. It can be on anything that you want, so long as it in some way, shape, or form deals with government. I need your topics. All right? I don't think I set a date on my website. I don't remember. But find something that's government related that you're interested in and send me an email. Say, hey, professor, I want to write about. It could be about current events. It could be something that was historical. But again, it has to be in some way, shape, or form related to government. All right? Enjoy the terrible snow that we're going to get tomorrow. We're probably going to get like another inch, so if you have a class, it's probably going to get canceled. Crazy.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.